Welcome to Organic Matters. Glad you tuned me in. Well, for those of you who do, every week, it's a growing audience. It's really been kind of fun. So after I got another writing about the carbon footprint of making and using concrete, the person that wrote me back asked, why don't we use stone anymore? I mean, is it time to revert, or am I missing some fundamental issues? I think he or she had a point. The truth is, a number of architects and engineers now are suggesting that we should use more stone and far less concrete. And there are a number of places around the nation now that are building homes with far more stone, especially local stone, where they're in the areas where it's already near. It actually makes it even more economical than ever, and sure does save a lot of carbon footprint from making and using cement products. In areas where stone is already abundant, its use is virtuous environmentally and highly contextual. It fits well, drawing on local resources and engaging the regional economy. Territory, city, and architecture are thus brought together by kind of this ancestral use of a very, very available material. In addition, the energy necessary to extract, cut, and lay stone is still limited in comparison to the use of many other materials. It undergoes little transformation, and its intrinsic properties are conserved in the process. Having basically come out of the earth from a geological layer somewhere, stone becomes a resource. It's kind of imbued. It's kind of got a new purpose and a new meaning, and is becoming more and more economically feasible. A structural engineer I recently read about, his name was Steve Webb, claimed in a recent article that stone is being replenished all the time through plate tectonics in unimaginable volumes. We don't realize how that's happening, and is practically inexhaustible. It's a replenishable natural resource created by geothermal energy. Almost all construction materials are extracted like stone. Timber, one of the few which isn't, is considered a sustainable material with good reason, but growing occupies a lot of space with monocultural forests, which kind of mess up the environment, for long periods of time. A tree, the average tree takes about 25 years to grow 1.5 cubic meters of material. If we quarry the stone under the tree, we can recover about 500 cubic meters. 1.5 versus 500 of stone in a month to get it out. Although quarrying is highly intrusive and disruptive while it is being carried out, fully exploited quarries can be returned to nature, backfilled with either unwanted soil or reused use for other purposes, or in many areas where I came from, became a viable source to hold water. They became lakes that hold a water source for reuse down the road. And for those of you that have listened to my cement talks, I call them, do realize that stone has a significantly lower carbon footprint than steel or steel and concrete that it replaces in construction. A little food for thought here. The energy required to make cement and steel is used in extraction, processing, and transportation. The processing is the fiery hot business, folks, of changing limestone into cement, or fiery hot to make iron ore into steel. In the case of stone, the energy is really only required for the extraction and to get it there, for transportation. No fiery processes, no carbon made at all there except what it took to get that out of the ground. Making stone has less than half the carbon footprint of concrete, and stone is often more than 2.5 times stronger than the concrete we make. In the case of some dolerite, stone is as strong as steel when it is compressed properly. French architects used a lot of stone after the Second World War because coal and concrete were really in short supply. And they then at that time even developed new technologies to cut it quickly and with great accuracy. They might add, the structures they made were astonishing. Modern buildings, kind of ennobled by their structural honesty and the use of all natural materials. Until recent times, stone was actually broken by drilling, wedging, and splitting. And later on, you know, they even used jackhammers when they came along. Today, however, the stone you see in the building is actually cut with computerized diamond saws. It's very exacting. And here I should mention, as we go along, carbon taxes are going to force up the cost of steel and cement to the point that at some point they would probably be almost unaffordable for general building. We will instead use stone, which is going to and has already began to unleash a really new architecture that at some point in the future will probably take over a good deal of that market. And Webb's not alone in his respect for stone. Back in 2013, there's another architect named Brent Ehrlich. He wrote a piece in Green Building magazine titled Stone, the Original Green Building Material, where he quoted architects with serious environmental credentials. I think we've done a disservice to stone, said Jason McLennan. He's a commanding officer of the International Living Future Institute. Stone is as elemental a building material as we can have. In its simplest form, stone is cut from the earth, tooled, and installed. That's it. Now, there is no perfect building material, but stone is about as close as we can get to perfect at this time, at least. I mean, think about it. Many new green materials or products, on the other hand, are manufactured, often using petrochemicals and components transported, sometimes from around the globe. And I should mention here, there are a whole lot of host of issues with these products. And we sometimes overlook products like stone that are sometimes literally, where I live at least, staring us in the face. I did used to look like, for sometimes, like the big holes in the ground that were where stones were quarried. And I live in an area where there's a couple of stone quarries. I've always thought that quarrying was equivalent to mining, but think about this. But it is really more benign for sure. It takes 143 pounds of rock to produce a pound of copper. With quarrying, it's almost pound for pound. If you compare quarries, for instance, to even modest forestry operations, the habitat impacts are a mere fraction of what they are with logging and milling wood and tearing up the land to get to the wood and get back out of it. Probably way more efficient, really, in the big picture. And to kind of tie this up with my organic matter show, which started years ago as a gardening show, I've made several, I guess more than several, all stone built up gardens. It takes a little bit more effort to get them lined out and get the stone to the house instead of using just cinder block. But first of all, the results are most always more attractive, number one. They're permanent, number two. And number three, you've made a far, here you are trying to be, or me at least, an organic gardener and take care of the earth and then turn around using cement or haydite blocks to build the thing. It was actually kind of the exact opposite of what my intention was. So anyway, that's kind of my take on stone, of all things. There's lots of it. We're not producing. It is making more of itself on a daily basis. And way, way less impact on the environment around us than almost any other natural product I can think of. For the last few minutes of this portion of Organic Matters, let's talk about something since, again, this started as a gardening show, about gardening. This week specifically, we're going to talk a little bit about just how do we measure the health of soil. With average temperatures going up everywhere, I mean, we're reaching record temperatures this summer, along with some of the driest conditions that have been measured since 1976, from what I could find. Then we have to consider what I call ongoing concerns about food security, wildlife habitats, and biodiversity. Having a healthy soil system is more vital and challenging than ever before. But what does the term soil health mean, and how should we measure it? Over in the UK, new research from Cranfield Nottingham University says that how we think about, measure, and study soil has got to be changed to give a better kind of a profile, a better understanding of how to manage this resource effectively. With academics proposing an entirely new approach for assessing the health of our soils. And I'm talking in this case about our own gardens, our built-ups that we do, all of us, well, that are into gardening, that's why most people listen to this show. Although soil health is a term, it's quite widely used now. I've been using it for years. It's actually problematic as it means different things to different people. And there is no single agreed way at this point to measure the overall health of our soil system. Our current approaches actually measure individual soil properties and use these to try and assign a single number giving an overall soil score. Well, that's not even sensible if you think about it. But these researchers argue that that does not reflect the wider system perspective that's needed to fully appreciate the condition of a soil and its health over time. So the proposal is a whole new system approach to assess soil health based on a new framework which takes in several measurements. I'll make this short, but we'll do it quick. Signs of life, characterizing the organisms that exist in the soil, which we know is more important than ever. Microbiome, microlife is what I'm talking about. Signs of function, that's the extent to which the soil processes the materials once they get there, back to the biolife of that soil. Signs of complexity, the extent to which soil components are connected and interdependent on each other, which is, again, more so than we thought, at least until recent times. It's as we are. Everything is one big interactive system. Soil is the same way. And signs of emergence, I don't have a better term for that. The extent to which soils respond and recover to multiple stressors. And what is a multiple stressor? You're planting in it over and over if you don't re-nourish it. You're planting in it over and over if you don't give it new organic matter. Stresses from extreme heat, which is getting to be more and more of a problem, and occasionally, and in some places, extreme cold. We are not with these one-number concepts that you get. You know, the one I used to get was from Texas A&M, and I don't know what they're doing these days. We need to have a whole new profile picture of our soil so we have an idea of where it's coming from and where it's going almost at any given time. In a nutshell, it's kind of hard to understand the importance of having a healthy soil system. It has to support wildlife and biodiversity. It has to reduce flood risk, store carbon, and give us food security. It has to grow things that we want to eat. So going towards this new model of assessment is going to take some help, and it's going to take some time, and we'll figure out so that we can learn to study and have a picture of the sustainability of the global soil resources we're going to use on out from our future generations. And again, that includes my little 4x8 and my little 4x4 gardens that I do. We will come up with, they are working on a source that'll make it here's the picture and here's what we need. But folks, it's going to take time. Thanks for staying tuned to Organic Matters.